Hi, I'm Brooks. I'm an addict and alcoholic. And thank you. You can all hear me, right? Yes? Yes? No? Stand up closer. Yeah, I'm Brooks, and it doesn't matter how many times I speak, I'm always a little bit nervous, and kind of more so tonight because I used to work here. And I know a lot of you, and I've enjoyed working with a lot of you. And I've enjoyed seeing a lot of you out in the community at meetings, so it's super kick-ass. I get to see y'all. Let's see, where should I start? I grew up on the border in McAllen, Texas, where my parents went to escape their parents. Both my parents grew up in Waco, Texas, and they became they also became alcoholics. They were really young when they had my sister and I, and they moved to the Valley. And what I can say is my first drug was sugar. And my mom would put me in front of the TV with a bucket of icing and a spoon. And that was kind of my babysitter, so I grew up watching Different Strokes, A-Team. If any of y'all are born in the 80s, you might remember some of these shows, or grew up in the 80s, rather. I know that I never quite felt fully secure growing up, and I know that this is something that I have in common with a lot of you, because I've heard your stories. It's like, even from early on, like I remember, like some of my earliest memories were in pre-K. And I think is the earliest I can remember. And I was in pre-K, and there was a little boy who used to mess with me. He would just give me a hard time, and I felt super insecure, and I couldn't figure out why I was being singled out. And I kind of felt that way throughout my school years, young, feeling like there was something fundamentally different about me that led to me getting singled out and messed with or bullied. And so it was pretty bad for me. I was three. I was scared, and he was a little bit older. And I complained to my mom, and she didn't really do anything about it. And so I stayed at that daycare or whatever. And I think that at that time I kind of got the message that if you ask for help, you may not actually get any help. And though I knew that my mom loved me, I felt that whatever else she had going on in her life was clearly more important than whether I felt safe. And so I kind of got that message early on. And I think those of you who've also grown up with alcoholic parents or chaotic families may also have experienced some things like that, where for whatever reason you don't quite feel secure or safe growing up. And so I kind of started to establish if I ask for help and I'm not going to get it and I'm not as important as other things, then I guess I have to take care of myself and it's not okay to ask for help. So that started early. And I went on to, elementary school, and it's like I couldn't figure out why I couldn't fit. I tried to have the right toys. I tried to have the right clothes. I tried to talk to the right people. And for whatever reason, I just wasn't able to connect. And something that I can see when I look back is that I was pretty angry as a kid, and other people might have actually caught on to that. Both my parents there's a lot of distractions. I'll say that. I'm like, anyway. Both my parents were kind of in their own world, and my dad was an attorney and a drunk, and my mom was doing everything she could to try to make sure that my dad didn't regret marrying her. There was a lot of serious codependence there. I think ultimately, what I know now is that my mother's preoccupation was with whatever was going on with my dad. So she was kind of satelliting around my dad. And my sister and I, though we definitely had our basic needs met, sometimes we didn't feel like we got, you know, the nurturing that we needed to feel secure and feel good about who we were and to feel have that self-worth. So anyway, so we were always kind of trying to figure out what was wrong with us, thinking that it was us. And we would do different things to try to get attention. My sister kind of was more turned inward. I was kind of more in your face. So if you don't like me, I'm going to hit you until I make you like me. That didn't work very well. But eventually, my family switched me to a public school. And like I said, I grew up on the border of Mexico and Texas. And I was a weird little white girl who didn't fit in with anybody. And I couldn't. So when I made the switch to public school, I really didn't fit in. And I wasn't cool. And my mother still dressed me. And that was unfortunate. And, oh my God, some of the outfits, I look back. And I, so I got bullied a lot in elementary school and beginning of junior high. I got bullied a lot. It was pretty bad. I was scared a lot. Really hypervigilant, you know, kind of always like watching to see who was around and really fearful about how people would perceive me if anyone saw me or, you know, whether or not people liked me. I would try to be likable. I would do whatever I could to try to be likable. So I would even try to get people that I didn't like to like me. And I was just kind of always focused on the outside and what was going on outside of me because I was trying to create safety. I did try to reach out to my mom sometimes to ask her, how do you make friends? Like, how do you feel, you know, secure with people and make friends? And, of course, my mother had no clue. Neither of my parents really ever had any friends growing up. They never really socialized. There just wasn't much going on there. And it's like my dad would socialize in the bars, but, you know, those weren't real friends. And they were his drinking compatriots, just like a lot of us have. So anyway, so that was, I never really knew how to function. And it's just like a lot of us, it's like I felt like I was born maybe the day after the instructions were handed out on how to live. Like I missed that day. Like I missed that day. And so it's like trying to put together IKEA furniture without the instructions. That was what life was like for me. And just kind of trying to look at the picture and figure out how to get the picture to look right. And so I would try to get people to like me and try to figure out what was cool. And eventually, after kind of around sixth grade, I was in middle school at this point, the way it was down there. It was like sixth, seventh, and eighth. And there was a lot of kids who were coming over from across the border. There was a lot of the Mexican mafia. Older kids, much older kids who were in the school with me. And so it was scary. There were times it was really pretty scary. And so after I got into a few fights, I finally started to realize that I was never going to be, I was never going to be Mexican. I tried, but I was never going to be Mexican. And I was never going to be a chola. I was nothing believable about me being a chola, those of you who know what that is. And it just wasn't working. So I finally kind of once I understood that there was no point in continuing to try to get these individuals to like me. And so I started to carefully craft my fuck you before you fuck me persona. And I got... Like I was always really attracted to anything angry, so I was really attracted to like metal and punk rock, and I got, I used to break things and set things on fire, and you know, it's just, I had a lot of anger because I was frustrated. You know, I was a child who didn't know how to get her needs met and constantly felt frustrated, and, you know, didn't know what to do with my feelings and with my anxiety and with my, you know, desperate desire to connect and not being able to connect. So I, anyway, so that kind of started around that time, around 11. And I had my first drink that I sought myself when I was 8, and I tried to make a mixed drink, which turned out badly. I thought all clear liquids, all clear alcohol was the same. So I took this like frozen concentrate orange juice and put it in a blender with gin and vodka and whatever else we had that was clear. And it was more like a lump, that frozen lump with liquid around it. And I tried to drink it. And then I tried to get my friend to drink it so that I wouldn't feel like I was being weird. And she was completely horrified by what I was doing because she's not an alcoholic. For me, I was just like, no, you need to drink this. You need to drink this. And she wouldn't. And I tried to. But I also had my first cigarette around that time. But I didn't really become a regular smoker until I was 10. So I waited till I was much older. And I, you know, back then you could steal cigarettes really easily. They were all by the counter. You just knock them into your bag, which we did. But also, like, because I was trying to develop this person that wouldn't get beat up anymore, I started getting in trouble on purpose. So I would intentionally get caught with cigarettes. I would intentionally cuss at the teachers. I would get into fights I knew I could win. I just sort of created this sort of person, and it worked. I quit getting into fights. I mean, I just got into a few fights, and then, you know, once people stopped messing with me, it worked. I didn't have to worry about fighting anymore. I just, you know, did my thing. And during this time, my father's drinking got pretty bad, and I think when I was 12, my dad's kidneys failed. And I had my first boyfriend. He was a freshman in college, and I was like 13. Yeah. I always used to say that if I was going to write my memoir, it was going to be called Unsupervised. So that was definitely what was going on. And anyway, so Dad's kidneys failed. And they eventually, my mom got really, really serious into praying. She'd always kind of been a nominal once a week churchgoer, although she was involved in her church. But when my dad's kidneys failed and he was in the hospital, she really started praying a lot. And then they magically started working again, and the doctors didn't really understand why, but we kind of looked at this as like a new lease on life. And he turned 40 around that time, and he was trying not to drink, and he became very mean. And, you know, he was always like the happy, embarrassing drunk who would flirt with everybody in front of all of us. But when he tried to quit drinking, he was dry, and he was mean, and he would say really cruel things, and he would get, you know, moderately physical with me. And I was also 12, 13 years old, and so I was full of piss and vinegar, and I was at this point in my life where I had all this anger, and it was a rough time. It was a rough time, and Dad couldn't get work anymore. So Mom and Dad, my sister graduated from high school already, and she'd gone to college, so it was just me and my parents. And we moved to Waco. And I was 14 when we moved to Waco. And Waco is not the valley. And I felt like I was just starting to kind of figure out how to live without getting beat up, without feeling, you know, I was starting to, you know, find my people around that time. And then we moved. And so I didn't have people again. So I moved to Waco and immediately found more people. I spent a lot of time with older ex-cons, pedophiles, just various criminals, the criminal element of Waco. Those were the people I ended up hanging out with. There were other people at, you know, my age, but they were all fucked up too, and a lot of them are dead now. So those were the people that I ended up kind of surrounding myself with. I drank throughout high school. It was my first drunk. I remember we played quarters, and I think I drank like two cases of beer with two other people, and I ended up with a little. I probably was poisoned, and I remember watching the carpet come up to my face and trying to figure out what was happening. But what was actually happening, if you were standing outside, was I was going like that. I just boo like that. But I still remember it like visually. I was like, why is that? What's happening? What's happening? And the carpet was getting closer and closer to my face. But yeah, I was just falling on my face. And then all of the bikers that were smoking meth at my friend's coffee table were laughing as I was crawling to the bathroom to throw up everything inside of myself. And that was when I was like 13 or 14 years old. And my mom had no clue what was going on. And again, my mom was kind of focused on my dad. And my dad was trying to figure out how to have a job, get a job, keep a job, and trying to be sober. And he wasn't very successful. Dad would bribe me not to tell my mom by buying me alcohol. And it just, you know, I was cleaning up after my parents when my mom started getting drunk more often. And you know, she would microwave the ice cream. And I just remember all these different really ridiculous things. When my mother would get drunk, she would just go straight to a blackout. And so I'm like a teenager, and I'm having to kind of deal with what's going on with them, and I'm really resentful about it. And I'm also in high school. And, yeah. So anyway, kind of moving along, I drank in high school, and I know I drank alcoholically. Of course, I didn't drink every day because it wasn't accessible every day, and it didn't occur to me to drink every day. I did keep vodka and tequila in my closet, just in case. And I was always hyper aware that it was there, and I was always coming up with stupid reasons why I needed to drink it. You know, I felt like I had to have a reason, right? So it was at those early days where I felt like I had to have a reason. And the only reason I didn't drink every day is it just didn't occur to me that people did that. And eventually, in my senior year of high school, my father died of cirrhosis. And my mom was, you know, my dad was all that my mom satellited around. So when he was gone, she was completely lost. And there was me. So I kind of became mom's surrogate husband for a while, and she couldn't make any decisions without me. She was on, you know, talking to me all the time. I felt a lot of guilt about going to college and leaving her by herself, but I went, and I did well at first when I wasn't really thinking. I was just sort of like, you know, that overachiever. I did well my first year of college, but then I discovered acid and other various drugs that I had always been surrounded by growing up in high school, but I was trying to be like this punk rock nonconformist, so I never smoked weed, even though it was always around. I never did any other drugs except for alcohol. And once I hit college, I kind of lost or let go of that line, and so I started experimenting with other things. And just, I feel like my life was always full of stupid drama. Just like, you know, as a kid, there was all these stupid fights. And then in high school, there was always, you know, guys and other people's crap and fighting. And there was just all this in my family. And then in college, it's just stupid drama. Like, I just sort of naturally gravitated towards insanity. And you know, I talked about how my first drug was sugar, and I would crawl all over the cupboards, I would hide in closets eating cookies, and then eventually I discovered sex and alcohol, and that was around high school. And so that was another, well, not so much a drug, but that was a tool to get self-esteem. I was trying to get people to like me, and I discovered that if I could get a guy to like me, that fed that little need for about a few hours. And then, you know, eventually I felt even worse than I felt before. So it was just that cycle. That's part of where all the drama came from. And that cycle continued in college, and I started drinking more. And once I turned 21, I was pretty much drinking every day. I eventually moved to Austin, and I was going to UT for a while. I graduated from there the first... So I went to UT, and I graduated from UT, but it was kind of this sort of all kinds of crazy shit went on that took me forever to get my first degree. I got arrested a couple of times, a DWI, hit and run, plenty of other things that happened that, you know, waking up in places I didn't know where I was, with people I didn't know who they were, and just getting into lots of wrecks with my car. And eventually I did manage to graduate, and I was afraid. I felt like Austin was the problem. Because this was where I was, that I partied every day, drinking every day. And so I decided to get my teaching certificate and move back to Waco, where I thought that I would somehow be able to make things look normal. Because just like what I was saying earlier with that IKEA furniture, not having the instructions and just trying to make the picture work, that's what I was trying to do with my life. You know, I was trying to get the picture of normalcy so that I could fix the way that I felt. And so I thought if I became a teacher, that would force me to be responsible. And, you know, because of the gravity of the responsibility of trying to be a role model. And I went to Waco, and I started teaching middle school. But when I wasn't working, I was drinking. And because it was Waco and I didn't like it and I didn't like anybody in Waco, I drank a lot in order to be able to tolerate the people that I was drinking with. And I remember consciously going into the bar and pounding shots really fast so that I could like the people that I was there with. And there is also always the waking up with shame and then having to drink in order to drink through the shame, to try not to remember what I had done the night before. But anyway, so I taught school. It was terrible. I was terrible. I was not a good teacher. I quit, and I thought I would move to another town. I moved. I was couch surfing for a while. I was unemployed for a while. And for like a year or a year and a half, I didn't do anything except drink and live off my mother. And eventually I decided I felt guilty, I should get a job, so I got a teaching job, not in Austin, but not too far away. And my logic was that if I'm not in Austin, I'm not going to drink every day and I'm not going to go to shows every day. And there's only one bar in that town that I moved to, like one or two bars. So I'm not going to drink in those bars because then people will see me and I'm a teacher and I can't do that. So I was trying to create my environment to force me to be responsible. And that never really worked. This is just sort of evidence that I had no idea how to make any change in my life. I was always trying to arrange circumstances to force me to change, but I couldn't. It never worked. It just never worked because I was the one involved in that. And it was this brain that was coming up with the idea. So eventually, of course, I ended up drinking at these bars, and I did kind of make a mess out of myself. And I eventually started commuting to drink in Austin. And then as I was commuting to drink in Austin, I discovered that cocaine helped me drive drunk sober so that I could get back home. So I started doing cocaine, and I had all kinds of rules about it, and I violated every rule. I'm never going to buy it. I'm never going to spend more than a certain amount. I'm never going to take it home with me. I'm never going to use it during the week. I'm never going to use it at work, and just on and on and on. And I broke every single one of those rules, and eventually I decided to move back to Austin and then commute to work instead. And so I was in Austin drinking every day. I had a new Coke habit. I had a guy that I thought was going to fix everything because he was normal and had a good job. So I thought that I've got my picture. You know, I've got my job, my straight job, even though all of my friends were all still relatively fucked up, but I was the one with the straight job, you know, a nine-to-fiver. And trying to live this life, you know, this dual life. And I eventually, there were times where, how late am I talking? Till 8, till when? 20 after. Oh, good, I got plenty of time. I was trying to, like, speed it up because I thought I only had 10 minutes. Okay, so I move back to Austin. I have this guy that I think he's going to fix everything and give me that picture. But like I said, I had this cocaine habit. And I also had the inability to say no to anybody who would give me attention. So that made it very difficult to stay monogamous. I did, sort of, if you have a loose definition of what monogamy means. More so than I had ever done before. I tried really hard. But I had this cocaine habit that just got increasingly more serious. And the more attached I was to this relationship being what I had to have, and every time I saw signs of trouble, it increased my anxiety, and my drug use and my drinking increased right along with it, to a point where I became so insane, you know, he finally ended the relationship. And at that point, the wheels kind of fell off. It's like I didn't have as many reasons to try to straighten up and look normal because I no longer had this relationship. And so I moved some people into my house with me who used meth. And they showed me how to smoke meth. And they told me about all of the benefits of meth. Meth lasts longer. It's cheaper. And of course, you know, I wanted to, I was spending a lot of money on cocaine. So I started smoking meth. And I was still teaching school at this time. So if you look at my timeline, I didn't really start doing narcotics until I started teaching high school. And that's not usually how people go, but I tried to avoid it for a long time, and I think some part of me knew that if I started using stimulants, then I was probably going to like them. And actually, I think that's not true, because I discovered ephedrine in college, and that basically is the same thing. So I went through this period of time where I didn't eat food. I ate ephedrine and coffee for about a year and got super skinny and super crazy. Yeah. It's funny how it's like I was always self-conscious about how I looked, and I always felt like I was huge, even when I wasn't. You ever heard this joke, I wish I was as fat as the first time I thought I was fat? Yeah. But anyway, so I finally lost a lot of weight, and I got thin, but I was so insane, I couldn't hold conversation with anybody. But anyway, that was in early college. But anyway, at this point, I've graduated college, I'm teaching, I'm smoking meth, and I'm hanging out all hours of the night, I'm going to shows, I'm going to after parties, and then I'm somehow getting my shit together to go to work in the morning. But I'm not really present. And I wasn't, you know, I did not know what the hell I was doing. And I was too insecure to ask for help on how to be a teacher. I didn't know what I was doing. And I thought I was supposed to always look like I knew how to do everything the first time I did it. And so my poor students, you know. So anyway, So eventually I kind of quit showing up to work consistently because I couldn't stop. I was using all night, and it's like I knew that I was going to have to get up at some point to start getting ready for work, and I just couldn't stop. And so I ran through a long list of different types of excuses, like, you know, I'm sick, my grandmother died, she died twice, I think. I couldn't keep up with all my excuses. There was at least one time where I came out of a blackout in the middle of a lecture I was giving on Shakespeare. And I kind of remember, like, I realized I came out, and I'm, like, standing in the front of the classroom talking to my students, and I just kind of was like, what was the last thing I just said? Trying to remember what I just said and then just fake it and hope that nobody noticed that I just kind of realized where I was. So, yeah, it wasn't good at all. Anyway, so once I started smoking meth, I had a really hard time stopping. I wasn't getting into work consistently, and eventually they asked me to stop coming. And so I only taught school for like 3 years. And there was a bit of a break in between that, too. So anyway, once I lost the job, it was mortifying having to go up to the school and get my belongings and have my students see me like packing up my classroom and leaving. And this is before the school year was over. And whenever people would ask, so how's it going? You know, what are you doing? What's going on in your life? You know, and I had no good answers. My family, I quit talking to my family because I had nothing positive to report. And I was just in this sort of perpetual state of shame, just shame, embarrassment, guilt, disgust. And so I just used and drank. And hung out with other people who were really, really fucked up individuals. And, So I was always concerned that I was going to become psychotic, like some of the other people I used with. And, you know, I would watch people like get really violent and kind of psychotic and kind of crazy using meth. And so I thought that what I would do is I would use coke and meth alternately so I wouldn't become too addicted to either one. And I was conscious, like some part of me was conscious of what was happening. And just once I lost my job, all I did was use, and things were really bad, and people were threatening to kill me because I'm a really terrible criminal. And eventually someone broke into my house and stole all this stuff that my grandmother had given me. And she had died not that long before. So that was like kind of the beginning of the wake-up call. Like I was already aware that things were really bad. I destroyed this relationship. I lost my career, destroyed my career. I'm telling my mother she needs to quit calling me because it makes me feel guilty. And that she needs to stop loving me. And because I felt bad and I had nothing to say. I had nothing good to say to give her any relief. And I didn't know how to stop and I didn't know what to do. But eventually, like once these people stole this stuff, this jewelry that my grandmother had made for me, from my great-grandmother's jewelry, for me that was like a really serious thing that I had fucked up, and I felt the full weight of that. Like I had been entrusted with something as a family heirloom to pass down, and I'd screwed it up. And for me, that meant a lot. So I called my mom and told her I would go to treatment. And for me, the reason to go to treatment was sort of like I needed to make a dramatic gesture to try to make amends for screwing up and allowing this jewelry to get stolen. And I wasn't really fully thinking about getting clean. I think what my plan was to get some therapy, get a massage, and a few good meals, and then I would stop using the cocaine and just drink normally. Because if I just got some really intense therapy, then I would be able to handle my alcohol. So I went to treatment, and you know, I remember the search for treatment took a lot of phone calls while I was high yelling at people about Judeo-Christian concepts. And they told me I could believe in a light bulb, and I bought it, and I went to treatment. And what I discovered is this facility that I went to, they did first step meetings every day in the morning. And I was introduced to that book that's over there, and I brought my copy, but I was introduced to the fact that there was a book that went along with AA. It wasn't just going to meetings. There was a program that actually had steps that weren't just things that you thought in your head. It was something an action that you took. And I discovered that I'm not an alcoholic or an addict because of what I drank and what I used. I discovered that I'm an alcoholic and an addict because of how I am when you take it away from me. And that all of my problems preceded ever picking up a drink or a drug. Like, I didn't know how to live life. I didn't know how to connect with people. I didn't know how to feel comfortable in my own skin. I didn't know how to do anything. I never felt comfortable. I never felt right in the world. And alcohol helped me to feel like I connected. You know, I remember my first real drunk that was a happy drunk with Strawberry Hill, Boone's Farm, Strawberry Hill. And right away, it's like, I felt super good. And I bought, like, I would walk around with, like, a bottle in each pocket and one in each hand. Like, that was, like, right away. I did never drink normal. Never, ever drank normally. And I was introduced to what my problem was. And the problem is that I have a disease that affects my perceptions. It affects the way I look at the world. It affects the way I connect with world or don't connect. It's, without going into all kinds of physiological stuff, it's in my brain, and I can't fix it, and I can't change it. I can't make it go away just because I want it to go away. So I have to do this work in order to learn how to live. So these steps, this program, gives me tools to learn how to handle life, not to fix my drinking, but to learn how to handle life without it. And that's what, you know, when I first went to treatment, I it was more like kind of just sort of knocking the crust off, you know. It's like, I realized that there was this program. I kind of learned about the nature of my disease. I started trying to work the steps. I got a sponsor who didn't have a lot of experience, and she kind of took me through her own version of the program. And I was recognizing that I wasn't having the same experience that other people were having, but I didn't know what to do about it. And so I decided to just focus on my job and go to meetings sometimes. And eventually I ended up drinking again. I ended up using again. And then I went to treatment again, but I only went to treatment because I felt guilty. And then I went to treatment for a longer time, trying to force myself to want to get clean. And that last place that I went wouldn't let me work the steps, so that didn't work out well. I ended up in South Florida, and I got kicked out of treatment. I relapsed in South Florida, and if you've ever tried to get drugs where you don't know anybody, in a town you don't know, it's really, really scary and ugly. And I found myself smoking crack in the Miami ghetto. It was like the scariest, scariest place experience I've ever had. And the fact that I didn't get raped and murdered during that time is absolutely a fucking miracle. But I survived that experience. It was pretty ridiculous. And eventually, when I was ready and I ran out of everything, I asked somebody that I'd met in recovery there in Florida to move in with me. And he cleaned out my place, got rid of everything, and he took me to meetings. And I went to women's meetings and gay meetings with him because I was trying to avoid getting in a relationship. So I realized, you know, like I said earlier and I alluded to earlier, is I had a very difficult time turning away any kind of attention that was given to me because that was the only way I got self-esteem. And when I was trying to get sober, that trying to get my self-esteem from other people was taking me away from working my program, taking me away from recovery. I was still trying to fix the way I felt just with through a person instead of through a beer. And that eventually got to a place where my first year of sobriety, you know, they always say stay out of relationships. So I was really trying to stay out of relationships by surrounding myself with women. I still did things people told me not to do. But I realized after kind of engaging with different people, even people in sobriety, like I thought, oh, they're sober, therefore they must be healthy. Not true. I learned that I hadn't grown enough. I wasn't strong enough to handle the pain of the shame that came from the rejection and the screwed up things that would happen when I would kind of get involved. Anyone who's attracted to you when you're in your first 30 days, there's something wrong with them. You need to be careful. And no matter how long they've been sober, if they've got 20 years and they're attracted to you at 30, 60, 90 days, something ain't right. And I tried, and I realized after attempting to do the impossible that I was going to use. I was so full of shame that I, and so like that feeling of just feeling rejected and gross, I couldn't handle that sober. I knew I wouldn't stay clean. So I threw myself into my program. I had a sponsor that I was afraid of. I told her everything, that the stupid shit that I've been doing, and I just doubled down. I went to a big book step study meeting every week. I got through my steps. I did a really thorough, crazy fourth step, and which has gotten better over the years. I do a better job than I did the first time, but it didn't really matter. It's like the first time, you're just sort of like, you do the best you can do at the time. And that's what I did. At the time, I was as honest as I was capable of being at that time. And it's gotten deeper and deeper. My experience has gotten deeper and deeper as I've stayed clean. Anyway, so I got clean 2/15/07 in South Florida. And I went to like 2-3 meetings a day, every day. I went to meetings every day. And I needed to surround myself with people because I would get lonely, and I would get, and it was, I was doing stuff that was counterintuitive, you know, diving into things that I would normally run away from. I was learning how to speak like rigorous, meticulous truth that I normally would have spun a story about. And so this was, I had to have constant support of other people who were doing this so that I could continue, because I was scared. I was afraid of who I was going to be. I was afraid of who I was going to become. And I had to set boundaries around my family. I couldn't be, I didn't go back home to Texas for about a year. I didn't spend time with my family. I talked to them, but I had to set boundaries because they weren't living life the way I was trying to live life. My family still likes to spin the truth and run away from anything challenging. So it was very, in order to live this life, I had to surround myself with other people who were living this life. And I spent about three years in Florida. My friend who helped me get sober, he passed away suddenly of HIV-related illness. And I couldn't find a job. I got a bunch of crappy jobs. I got fired from all my crappy jobs. I didn't want to go back to teaching, so I decided that it was time to start making amends to my family and coming back to Texas. So I came back to Texas in 2009. I had about 2.5 years sober at the time, and I was scared shitless of being in this town where I used and I drank and all I did was party. And I knew that guy, and he told me of a meeting I could go to. And as soon as I got into town, I went to like a 6 a.m. meeting, and then I ended up going to a meeting that was his home group at the time, and I met people, and they volunteered me or voluntold me for a service position really early. So I did this service position, and you know, what I will say is that, you know, I always hear my sponsees bitch about going to meetings, and they're horrified about the idea of going to meetings every single day. I went to a meeting every single day for at least my first 5 years of sobriety. And I did that because I needed the support, but I also liked having the support. And it also helped me to make sure that I stayed in the middle. So I did service work. I had a sponsor. I've always had a sponsor. I do the steps, sometimes shitty, but I still do them. And I still go to meetings very consistently. I work in a different facility now, and it's a very difficult job working in treatment. I'll tell you that. Don't become a therapist. Don't work in treatment. But anyway, it's one of those jobs. Sometimes it's a 50, 60-hour a week job, and I still get to meetings, and I still have sponsees. It's super important to my recovery because I need all of it. Some people you will find can get away with just doing, you know, some things. Maybe they just go to meetings. Maybe they talk to their sponsor occasionally just to tell them all the shit that they did they weren't supposed to do. Maybe they may read the literature sometimes. But me, if I don't do all of it, I'm in danger. And the thing is it's not even about drinking. It's about being an asshole. When I stop working this program, I become a real asshole because I'm full of fear. That's my default setting. I'm full of fear and anxiety, and I don't want you to know it. And so as soon as something makes me anxious, if I'm not working a program and praying or talking to someone about it, I'm pretending everything's fine and you're the fucked up one. And it causes a lot of conflict in my life. So I have to work a program in order to maintain that connection to reality, and because I will get disconnected from that really, really quick. And so, you know, kind of wrapping up, at this point, you know, it's like I work the program of AA in order to have some tools to handle life without alcohol, without drugs, and to feel good. I didn't just want to get clean. I wanted to have a kick-ass life. And if I didn't have a kick-ass life, I would not stay clean. And life doesn't mean that life is super easy all the time. It's definitely not. You know, especially, you know, you get some of the gifts of the program, like a job, and you have to work the job. I own a home. I have to pay my mortgage. I own a car. It's expensive. You know, life keeps happening. Friends die. Friends relapse. Life is just life, you know? It's just now I have tools that help me to handle life when it's happening, and I get to experience joy. And something that, you know, I don't know if you're familiar with Brené Brown, but she says that we don't get to selectively numb. So when I drink and I use in order to numb all the hideous, hideous feelings that I have or the shame, I'm numbing joy. I'm numbing all the good shit. And now, in order to be able to experience the good shit that there is in life to experience, I have to be able to walk through the bad shit sometimes. This program helps me to do that. And I am surrounded by people that love and care for me, that tell me the truth when I don't want to hear it, and that helps. And I just continue to do this every day, completely imperfectly, but I still do it. And I'm still here, like almost 11 years later. But thank you, guys.